Welcome to the ONC P-Core Research Data Use Scenarios Workgroup Meeting Number 9. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone stating your name and affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Eric Gapler-Rude. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon or good morning, wherever you are. This is Eric Gapler-Rude. I am substituting for Priscilla DeLab, who is on vacation this week and will be returning for the next stakeholder meeting next week. We will be following the same procedure that we have done for all of the earlier meetings going through today. We will be going through three research data use scenarios, and we will follow the same procedure, which is that Daniela and Iona will describe and discuss the data use scenario. If you have any questions or comments, please raise your hand over on the right sidebar or send a note in the chat function, and I will call on you in order. So thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate that we are getting such a high level of interest and of comments that we receive not only during these calls, but also we very much appreciate the comments and questions that are raised, the clarifications that are raised after these calls, or also as some of you are sending notes during the calls. All of them are noted, and we are incorporating them. And if we have a few moments, at the end we will briefly talk about where we are in status with the various data use scenarios that we have gone through and reviewed in the past. So today we are going to be focusing on the precision medicine scenarios. There are three of those, and we'll go through them in order. All of these are up, and we hope that you already have gone through them or will go through them up on the shared site. And we will turn these over to Daniela Daniela to take us through the research data use scenarios. Thank you. Daniela?
Thanks, Eric. So these are the questions that that you guys have seen already, so I won't belabor the slide too long, but the request is that when we're thinking about these scenarios and alternatives, that these kinds of questions are kept in mind and answered or considered. So without going through them one by one, I think we can advance to the first scenario. Okay, so the scenarios that we're talking about today were inspired in part by what's been underway with the Precision Medicine Initiative. They've been developed in collaboration with NIH, and we've received one round of feedback from them on these scenarios, and are eagerly anticipating your thoughts on these different kinds of scenarios and how they might impact precision medicine and your participation potentially in the precision medicine initiative more broadly, whether you've thought about these kinds of things. So the first scenario is related to an unintended compromise of family members' privacy in the case that research participants might actually be answering questions about their family members as part of questionnaires in research participation. And so while we were working through this scenario, we were trying to, you know, think of ways in which this kind of information might need to be disclosed ethically. So, you know, under what circumstances would we even have an obligation to disclose information about family members or to family members? And the the notion here is that there's a repository that has environmental health data as well as demographic data and participants' self-report of family history. And the researcher that is imagined in this scenario would be finding information about environmental health risks that could affect not only the research participants but the family members. And so there's a number of questions that came up when we were developing this that we thought we would get your feedback on. So if you can scroll down a little bit through the questions here so we can bring them up. The scenario has been developed in such a way that there has been a discovery made in research, and it may affect the family members who have been reported on by the research participant. So the first question here is related to what should happen at the consent time, at the time of consent. So should there be some time or some opportunity in the consent process where the research participant can opt out of being informed about research results? And often that's the term of IRB approval, that participants be informed of results that affect them. But is there a way in the process of consent that participants should be able to opt out of receiving that information? And then is there a case where family members should be informed in one way or another that information about them might be included in research repositories, especially repositories that are consented for fairly broad use? And what kinds of factors the IRBs should consider when they're trying to make these kinds of determinations? And so that's sort of another dimension of this. And finally, there's some questions that have come up in general about when participants find that they're at risk for a particular condition or their family members, what kinds of obligations fall on the research team in order to identify resources that can help participants that have been participating in research that reveals health risks that they might have or their family members might have. And there's a number of sort of sub-bullets on this around how we would identify counseling resources and what kinds of guidelines researchers should consider during the process of informing the research participants or family members, and whether or not there should be other kinds of protections put on family member data that is related to these kinds of repositories. So let me step back there and hear from the group about what you guys have experienced and what you think about these cases where there's privacy implications for both participants and family members.
Don't be shy. At the present, I do not. Lucilla.
Yes, I think you know, there is no way we should get into informing family members since they were not consulted, right? So I don't think there is any obligation whatsoever. That's one of the questions you posed here. Not only I don't think there is an obligation, but I'm not sure it would be the right thing to do anyway.
Sitting in the back of the bus is not over
there. I'm sorry, someone is speaking, but we can't quite hear them. Okay, Lucilla, can you say that again, because I think we may have gotten a little distracted.
Yeah, well, as for the one of the bullet questions, what obligations does the researcher have, if any, about informing participants or family members of findings? I think not only there is no obligation, but it might not be right to inform them since they might not even know about a family member participating in this research project. So I think it's no obligation in perhaps not even the right to inform.
Ed Hammond, Is that a does your question also build on that?
Yeah, it builds on that. And I mean, part of that, I think in some of the research that we're talking about, you know, the privacy shouldn't dominate some common sense with what you're talking about. And the although I recognize the fact that family members may not know that, but if you found something, I mean, you know, you can take the extreme case, and if an individual was infected with had a infectious disease of some sort that tended to spread, then you know, I think I find it difficult to really build a box around the research itself and not recognize the consequences of some of the things that you may find with other people. So it's a difficult problem to solve, but I think we shouldn't just uniformly not evaluate the circumstances and the significance of not sharing.
Are you guys aware of any... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I can give some specific examples. Obviously, one thing, and again, it depends on the kind of research that's being done, but certainly when we get into the genomics and the genomic research itself, I've had some circumstances in which looking at family history and things of that nature as part of an individual, recognizing that the person that is of greatest risk is other than the person participating in that trial, and whether that should be shared or not, I think is both an ethical issue as well as a good healthcare issue. And so I think those are some things that really need to be thought through. Other things that may not apply directly, but you know, lead in the water, it depends on the nature of the research that you're doing. But I think there are circumstances in which the significance of what you find in an individual has significance on a total family. And again, I think the word family needs to be defined more broadly, because it may be people not physically living in the same household, and you may have people living in the same household or not blood relatives. So I think all of that comes into play and needs to be clear in the definition of defining the guidelines.
Daniela, did you have a comment?
Well, I was actually just going to ask if anybody was aware of guidelines or if their institutions had any guidelines around these kinds of situations where the research reveals risk about individuals that are not necessarily participants in the research that the subject is participating in, and whether there was, you know, some obligation that could be transferred to the subject if that was the channel for communication to honor what Lucilla was describing.
I see Bob Gelman has his hand up. Is it on this topic, or is it a different topic?
Slightly different.
Let's see if we can answer the Daniela's question, then we'll move to you, Bob. Lucilla, or was that who was responding there?
Yeah, I was just going to say perhaps we should first look into guidelines of informing the individuals themselves about any particular findings, because there are guidelines for that, the return of results to the individuals, and we can dig those up at least from the American Medical Genetics Association. I might have been the wrong acronym, but there are guidelines on how to return the results to the particular individual. And I would say that comes first, and that to extend that to the family probably extends from what those guidelines are.
Anyone else like to comment or have experience with this issue? Okay, this has been clearly noted. Bob, would you like to ask your question?
Well, I have a comment. I mean, without disagreeing with anything that Ed Hammond said, because I think a lot of what he said is right on, I guess I have two points to make. One is, there was a case many years ago that involved the French Data Protection Commission, the CNIL. As I recall, and don't hold me to these facts, there was research going on, and it turned out that they discovered that among the research participants that some intervention would prevent these people from going blind. But there was no particular way in which those people could be contacted, and contact was in fact prohibited on privacy grounds. It's a rather shocking case in and of itself, and it may have evolved in some way that I don't know about or come out with a different answer at some point, but that may be worth looking into just as an example. The other point I want to make is, once you put an obligation of any type on researchers to contact people and give them information, you run the risk of creating all kinds of interesting legal liabilities. And it's very easy in some cases to deal with contacting people. In other cases, it's very hard to find people depending on the length of time. And when you get ambiguous research results, you have to notify people, you know, there's a 10% risk, there's a 20% risk, there's a 30% risk, there's an 80% risk. What do you do? And if you're staring the possibility of a lawsuit in the face, if you don't notify people, how does that change the scenario? I think all that needs to be thought through and cranked in here and making choices.
Does putting language about contact to family members, however that is defined, into the consenting process add, resolve, complicate these issues, you know, those that you've raised, Bob, and also Ed?
I think contacting people always makes things more complicated. For the reasons I cited and for other reasons. On the other hand, there are circumstances in which contacting people may very well be something that people would expect to happen, where an intervention may result in a much better outcome for people, and it's sort of hard. You get into a circumstance where you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, and you got to make some kind of choices and put some kind of boundaries about what you're willing to do and how long you're willing to do it.
This is Ioana. I think what I hear is that some guidance would be useful for researchers to include in their protocol definitions. So if there is a specific risk associated with not disclosing or not sharing that information with people, other folks who may be affected, then there is an obligation. Otherwise, there isn't, or at that point, it's left to some other entity to decide. I think it's some type of guidance, I think, is what I hear would be desirable in this case.
Yep. Now, this is Ed Hammond. Again, if we don't have those guidelines, then everybody who faces a problem has to deal with it separately and independently. And I think those guidelines will be extremely useful, even though it's an extremely difficult problem to solve, and there's not an obvious single answer to that. But guidelines at least would give us some way of beginning to understand what to deal with.
Exactly. Some type of decision tree that says, you know, if you meet these criteria, then you should consider this. If you don't meet these criteria, then you don't. And at least clarifies to the researchers what their next action should be.
Might there be any populations for whom disclosure would require either greater sensitivity or might be prohibited by other laws or regulations? In this context, I'm thinking about substance use or HIV risk or TB risk.
This is Laura. I was just going to mention that, you know, some states do have laws very specifically addressing, I'm thinking of particularly HIV disclosure, where they prohibit providers from disclosing information to an intimate partner, for example. So, you know, that would be a challenge, varying state laws.
Okay. Any other comments or reactions to the questions that are raised on this research use scenario? Okay, hearing none, let's move on to the next one.
And I think that this one will also allow us to push a little bit more on the return of results questions. And maybe we should have tried to tackle this in a slightly different order, but I think it's all sort of part of this tension between how researchers are returning results and the issues around that, and in particular how the research participants and their relations may or may not be empowered. And so this one was developed by exploring Huntington's disease in particular, with the notion that in this case the research results would be fairly definitive as opposed to something that might just be a risk factor. There's a very high certainty that if you identify the Huntington's disease genes, that you would expect the participant to actually manifest the symptoms. And there's very clear information about what the outcomes would be over time with participation. And the way this was developed was the idea that there would be not only the patients that are seeking care for Huntington's disease, but also their family members, and in particular minors, who would be children of the Huntington's patients. And then in this case the parents are giving consent on behalf of the minors, and the minors, if they're able to, are providing assent consistent with one of the preconditions that we had spoken of before. And there's follow up requests at the end of the study. So if we can move down to the questions here, there's a few things that came up in review of this. So the first question is whether the considerations change. So going to sort of what Eric was prodding on a little bit before, do considerations change if we're thinking about return of results to a minor who has been tested in the course of the research before they've actually achieved the age of consent? So are there any relevant state laws around this? Has anyone experienced this kind of scenario? Sort of returning to the question of whether people should be opted out or opted in of receiving these kinds of results when they're minors, and questions about whether the parents should have access to the results about their children for something that is as specific as Huntington's disease, or whether that information should be retained by the research team until some point in time when the results are relevant to the minor who's reached age of consent. And then also these questions around the timing and the level of detail and education of around the return of the results, and how much should be shared with them. So there's a series of questions here around the details of that. And we're thinking about considerations that should be put into place security wise on the return of results process, and what kinds of authentication might be needed in order for people to retrieve their results, and what should happen if there's accidental disclosures. And here the team brought up Gina as well as something that should be considered for this case where the biomarker has so much certainty. And the gaps that were raised are here at the bottom of the page. There are these questions of loss of autonomy and sort of the autonomy to know or to not know about the disease state for something like Huntington's, and any kinds of conflicts between a parent and a child in these cases. I think are there a couple more bullets on the screen here? Yeah, and so these questions at the very bottom are also related to the security of the systems that would be used to administer the process of return of results. So a lot of things that came up earlier, but I think in this case there was a lot more discussion around
around these two sort of angles, one being the sort of information systems that are used for return of results, and the other one being how you navigate a dynamic between family members when you have a lot of certainty around what the results imply.
We have a comment, questions from Ed Hammond. Ed?
Yeah, this is Ed. You know, to me, the answer to this question has a lot of factors, and one of the things that we might do is to encourage additional research in helping us understand this. But an individual from Duke had his whole DNA sequenced as part of George in the Harvard area that did that, and found out that he had certain genetic predictors, and he had young daughters, and his problem was trying to figure out what age he would do this. So I think personal preference, I mean, what do you want to know, what you don't want to know, whether it's something treatable or not, something in which intervention would make a difference to the outcome. I think those are all factors that come into play, and the age at which you reveal some of this information in both directions, I think, are factors. So it seems to me that one of the things that we need to do is to really encourage some funding of some research to really look into this and see what all the factors are that should impact the answer to some of these questions.
And Lucilla, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know that you have done some research around granular consent and the level of effort that and the kinds of responses that you're getting when people are exploring that level of granularity. Do you think that line of research that you have been working on could be extended in the way that Ed is describing to talk about these other aspects of consent?
Yes, because we are extending that now to understand proxy consent as well. So from the current work, which is quite limited in numbers and in settings, is one center only, and we approached about 1,000 patients about whether they wanted their electronic health records be used for research in a de-identified manner still, but whether they wanted or not, in who they wanted to share, and which portions they wanted to share. So the work is under review right now, but essentially people are concerned with certain items, family history being one important one, more than personal history from our results. And also they are concerned about financial information, which we were not aware of before, and with disclosure to for-profit institutions. So I think that, gives an idea that people are concerned about family members' impact. But I also think that a lot of it, given, you know, we're talking about individuals who are signing up for research themselves, in a way, I feel that anyone contacting others because of findings on that particular subject would betray their participation. Maybe they should know the results and they should decide whether to disseminate or not, unless there is a real definitive thing that could be done, and by not doing it, we're harming people. But I think those examples are extremely rare, and I think if they come, then they could be discussed separately. But as a rule, I think betraying the participants' pledge to do research in a certain way, bypassing them and going to try to contact family members or do something along those lines is probably, in my view, ethically wrong.
Does making the certainty or the greater probability of a diagnosis or a condition developing, in this case Huntington's, affect in any way the concerns and issues that Bob mentioned on the last scenario?
Well, I think you also need to think if there is something to be done about it, right? The actionable item, because many people culturally might not want to know of a certain outcome unless there is something they can do about it.
Anyone else want to weigh in on this? Does the probability of being able to affect an outcome, is that a something that is on a sliding scale? If you can do a little bit, or if it is a, if there may be incremental benefit to knowing, does that in any way weigh into advice on this? On this scenario. Okay. Any other comments about this scenario? Daniela, are there points that you want to press for clarification or advice?
Yeah, I think it would be great if people have more thoughts on this offline. If not during this call, their experiences, these cases where some of these legal boundaries versus ethical boundaries might need more clarification and understanding if there's obligations or liabilities that are associated with researchers communicating results back to participants. And the kinds of privacy concerns that are associated with that, and then these questions around whether or not there's something actionable. It seems like those are multiple dimensions of things that could be considered. And I know I'll just speak for Ioana, is that she would be very interested in understanding how we might manage this kind of information, and how long it needs to be stored and secured if, for example, something actionable were to come up, not as a result of the original research, but future research, how that might be managed and communicated. The granular consent has a lot of information already in it that needs to be managed, and then these kinds of questions of recontact and review of results would be another piece of a model that Ioana would want to include in this use case. So anybody that has thoughts on that piece of it would be great.
And we're trying to figure out as much as possible from a workflow standpoint without getting into the details of the data types at this point, because that's part of Clean 2, where exactly are these key decision points in the workflow when some of these privacy or ethical decisions need to be evaluated either by humans or by machines, by computers that can automate some of these workflow steps and activities. So we're looking for opportunities to present these requirements in a way that is easy to communicate to a diverse group of implementers, policymakers, legal experts downstream into the Clean 2 of this project.
Just add one comment. I think that you're right, that these may happen at different stages, but clearly it seems to me that these possibilities ought to be part of the consent process.
And so do you think that the IRBs should be responsible for ensuring that kind of information is getting into consents? I don't know how rigorously the IRBs enforce that kind of review of consent documents, but that would be a shift in guidelines for the IRBs as well as for researchers, right?
I think it's a tough question, but it seems to me that this is an important question for people to be aware of before they enter a study.
Is this is Eric, is there a difference, a qualitative difference between genetic risk and, say, infectious risk in a study? We're talking about genetic, you know, potential genetic transmission or identification of the genetic risk marker. But I can imagine scenarios where an index subject has a disease or exposed to a disease which may be transmitted to family members or others. And is there a difference in quality or in, you know, I don't know, riskiness, whether it's an infectious disease or it's a genetic marker? Now, if anybody has the insight in that one, send it to us offline. Okay, let's move on then to the third scenario.
Okay, so this scenario, also part of what was being considered for PMI, is a gene network study, and the process, as you know, as we've discussed before, is the preconditions have been met of obtaining IRB approval, and the purpose of the research is to get a better understanding of different kinds of genetic and behavioral risk factors for metabolic syndromes like diabetes and other issues. So the process involves collecting blood and saliva samples from participants and getting the data into a database, but it is not considering collecting data from covered entities. So this is sort of distinct from some of the things that we've been thinking about in use of EHR data. This would be more similar to what would be occurring in the volunteers portion of PMI. And so the research process is expected to involve reuse of this data. And the patients have already consented to multiple uses of the data, but in this case, there's a privacy risk that has been exposed based on a cryptographic finding. So a publicly available data set that's been made available to researchers is now vulnerable to attack by an adversary that is familiar with the cryptographic approach. These kinds of examples have been published in the past with respect to, you know, genetic databases, where people can find that there is really, even with aggregate data, there is high risk for re-identification in genetics. And so we wanted to bring this kind of question up with the group around what kinds of laws and governance structures should be established to address this kind of re-identification process, so re-identification in a publicly available research database, and whether there should be changes to consent forms that allow individuals to be made aware that there may be future risks based on innovations in computer science that might put their data at risk for a privacy breach. And what kinds of methods might be available to reduce these risks? Questions were raised on whether there's a particular physical structure that can be implemented to reduce the risk. So would an enclave approach where data is centralized be less risky than a federated model for storing these kinds of data? Then, you know, really narrowing into what kinds of harms exist if the data are de-identified, and then questions around whether the biospecimens that are informing these data should be destroyed, and whether or not that's helpful in protecting patients. And there's also some questions that were raised around what kind of obligations the individuals that had discovered re-identification algorithms, what kind of obligations those individuals have to alert either public institutions or the research teams themselves about their findings before making them available either in research journals or in other forums. So this is the kind of thing that we're exploring here, and I'm really interested in hearing what you guys have to say about sort of this tension between people that are innovating in discovering ways to re-identify data and people that are trying to protect privacy through other mechanisms that are not necessarily they're more related to security than a de-identification process. So I'll stop there and hear what you guys have to say.
We have a comment from Bob Delman.
Yeah, hi. This is right up my alley. A couple of years ago, I published a law journal article in some second-rate Fordham Law School law journal with a legislative proposal dealing with the risks of re-identification and basically the scheme, and I drafted the law in the article. If you can't find it easily, you can just send me an email. But the basic idea was everything's controlled with data use agreements, and data use agreements would then plug into this voluntarily into this statute, which would set the terms and make everyone accountable and provide for liability and enforcement and all sorts of things. But the key, and you can do a lot of this without having a statute, the key is that everyone who gets their hands on any of the data in any form has to sign the requisite data use agreement that says what they can and can't do and how they are allowed to or not allowed to re-identify data, whatever technology is available. And sort of that's sort of a general scheme for dealing with at least a lot of these problems. Nothing deals with all of them, but that gets you a long way down the road.
So do you think that kind of thing would protect against adversaries? So if there was someone that was really seeking to use this data in an adversarial way, would that protect against that? I think that this is something that I struggle with a lot, is, you know, whether we treat researchers as adversaries or whether we're treating them with some special kind of considerations because they're researchers, because I think your security concerns and those kinds of agreements still have sort of some good faith assumptions built into them.
Well, it's not just a matter of security, although that's always an issue. It's a matter of what you're allowed to do. Now, if a researcher or anybody else gets access to data in a way from somebody that they're not supposed to get access from, then somebody's liable for that or should be liable for that. That's the scheme. And if somebody does something with data that they're not supposed to do, then they would be liable for that. And that liability may include liability to the institution that provided the data. It might include liability to the data subject, who could turn around and sue people for that. And it might include, under the right circumstances, getting prosecuted and going to jail for certain kinds of misuses of data in the extreme case.
So this is Ivana again. I think what I hear is that, well, you know, evidently, if you're using data you're not authorized to access, that's one type of issue. But if you have the data, and then even if you have the technology or the means to re-identify the patient, if the rules are saying you shouldn't be doing that, I think that's a separate kind of issue. So it's not adversarial, but as much as, you know, setting the terms of the discussion to say you are authorized to use the data, but you are not allowed, even if you are smart enough to do it, to re-identify these participants. I think that's the distinction I'm hearing.
That sounds fair to me.
Lucilla, you have a comment or question?
Yes, I'm in perfect agreement that there should be data use agreements, because that doesn't mean, you know, we're saying researchers are not trustworthy, but in any community there are a few bad apples, and I think you need to apply policy and rules across the board. PMI will have citizen scientists as well, so it's not that they're covered under a particular institution. They are on their own, and they need to take responsibility for using that data. So with regard to the question, doesn't ENQUAVE reduce risk. It does not. It might reduce risk because people know they are watched in their logs of everything. But I think what does reduce is the consequences. If knowing if you do something wrong, then there would be consequences to that. With regards to the question of informed consent, I think many institutions, at least in here, we do that. We no matter whether data are considered HIPAA de-identified, the informed consent has a sentence that says there is some risk that the data could still be identified, re-identified. So I think that that's one thing that needs to be in there in all the consents, because it has been shown over and over that this is possible. And with regards to the question of whether researchers should work with the agencies or whoever before they publish their recipe for re-identification, I think most definitely. And the other thing is whether, you know, we're actually what service we do about publishing those recipes and timing of each thing to be done. So I'm in perfect agreement. There needs to be regulation on the part of who is responsible for the data and what can happen as a result of misuse.
I was going to ask, just to tie this back into sort of the sort of consent forms, and especially, you know, what people would like to be aware of. And for PMI, it's certainly imagined that there's going to be a lot of contact between the research community and the participant community, and to a certain extent, they might be heavily overlapping. Do you guys think that for these kinds of data use agreements that would be required, do you think that the research participants should be informed? Should they have to approve? What would the level of authorization for those use agreements by the participants? What should it be for any individual use?
This is Bob Gelman again. This asking research participants to try and decipher data use agreements is really asking a lot. And in a lot of these circumstances, and this is true of a lot of scenarios where there's contact with people, you know, is this going to be on page 27 of volume 3 of the informed consent agreement that we're going to get to these kinds of issues? I mean, how much can you expect the average research participant to understand and deal with and give opinions on? And then what are you going to do when everyone has a different opinion?
I'm hoping someone has the answer to that, because I don't.
But on the other hand, if there is going to be this constant communication with participants, why can't they be consulted? Because that's another, you know, kind of finding from what we had before. Most people want to know, want to be consulted. And whether there is an opt-out, that's fine. But I think we can't pretend we have means of communication and that's all constantly communicating with participants, engaging them. And then when it comes to the question of getting their approval for things, we say that's impractical.
Well, let me ask you a question. Every website and every phone app has a terms of service and often a privacy policy. How many times have you actually read any of those things for websites that you visited or phone apps that you use? The answer is people don't read any of those things, and they just accept whatever the default is. We know that from a million different circumstances. And unless you really want to sit down with people and educate them one-on-one about what all the terms are and what all the options are and what they mean and spend a lot of time and effort doing that, all you're going to get is a click-through.
Right, but let's say you simplify and you say there's a new research on vaccines and ADHD. Is it okay to use your data? And if you don't say anything, it's okay because you already consented before. But if you say, no, I don't want for this one, then that particular individual is removed from that particular research but continues in the cohort for everything else.
And how many different categories of research are you going to ask people about? 20, 30, 50, 100? How are you going to decide that?
Well, some of our participants from before said they don't want to be contacted for that, just use it. Some others say, tell me once a month, and some others said, I want to know every single one, every single time, which can be an annoyance, but that's what they have expressed their preference to be.
Okay, I think that we've seen, I'm not sure these are two polls, but these are two important sides of this issue of the use of the data. There's the last bullet question in here may be of a different quality, which is about the retention of biospecimen samples, and whether, and I'm not sure that this seems to be of a different type of inquiry than the one about disclosure. Any advice or recommendations about this last bullet that is a question for the group? Okay, well, hearing none, please continue if, as you think about these, you have any further advice or additional questions about any of these, please send them to us. Now, if we could go on in the last couple of minutes that we have, if you can go to the next one and just very briefly about this, where we are in the scenarios under development and then the future meetings. These are just a listing of the data use or the research use scenarios that are still under review. We're still looking for additional comments from you before we finally lock them down. There are these three plus the other ones that are also listed. So please, if you have any comments or questions, please send them to us, to the research team. Let's go to the next section. We've had two people typing furiously to record all of your comments and thoughts about the decision points that still need to be worked through. You have the materials that we've reviewed here and the updated other data use materials that are up on Confluence, and we will revise and post those updated versions for our next meeting. The next meeting, and this is, we are revising the schedule, the next meeting will only be on the, will be next week, next Wednesday. We'll reconvene next Wednesday, and then we'll hold two more consecutive meetings on the 20th and the 27th to close out this stage of the process of what we are calling CLIN 1, and we will turn the process then over to Jane and Laura and the GW folks for looking at the legal and ethical framework. I want to then thank you all for, again, a very thoughtful and very, very helpful process, and we look forward to speaking with you next week. Thanks again, and please feel free to comment, add questions, add more material. We'd love to see them. Thank you very much. Talk to you next week.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.